From gun violence to poverty to the threat of hurricanes, Florida's kids have too much stress. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, a sobering look at toxic stress and its effect on children here in Florida. Join us. The number to call up is 549-2937. Then later, don't miss the live and studio performance from singer-songwriter Andy Zipf. All of that and more just ahead. But first this hour, as Hurricane Dorian bears down on the Florida coast, it's just one more element of stress on this state that all of us, frankly, could do without, right? Well, that especially includes our kids, because the data shows Jacksonville's kids are simply not thriving. Increasingly, local children are dealing with the burden of poverty and community violence. The city, of course, has already passed 100 homicides for the year. We've got a major storm to worry about. There are other issues like domestic violence, parental incarceration, substance abuse, generational trauma. This is all deeply worrying for child advocates here on the First Coast, and their mission is to somehow create a more child-friendly city. We're going to talk about it right now as we welcome Mikai Owen, MD. He's Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at UF College of Health in Jacksonville, and he studies the effects of toxic stress on kids. Dr. Owen, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. What are your concerns about the effects of toxic stress on local children? The hurricane coming our way is just one example of many that we're going to talk about. And the number to call us up is 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open too. Well, Dr. Owen, I mentioned the hurricane. Everyone's stressed out about that. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, let's begin with the numbers, which you have at hand. Florida and Jacksonville especially do not rank high in overall child well-being. Why is that?
Well, I think it's for a lot of different reasons. So just to put the numbers out there, overall, Florida ranks 37th in overall child health and well-being, which is data across four different categories, so economic, education, and family and community factors. And in that, Duval County ranks 43rd out of 67th. So kids in Duval County are really kind of like the bottom third of the bottom third of the nation when it comes to child health and well-being. And I think really that's really rooted in a lot of structural causes from like segregation, institutional racism, historical and ongoing things, different tax burdens across the country and how much we invest in children. But overall, I think it just represents that for a long time, we've really lacked a comprehensive plan for child health and well-being in the city.
And we'll get to what you'd like to see in terms of a comprehensive plan for kids. But first, you study this. Toxic stress, you say, has a profound effect on children's brain development. Mm-hmm. How so?
So our brains are built like an ongoing construction project that begins with birth and continues into adulthood. And there's especially rapid development in the early years and again in adolescence. So like building a house, the foundation, how you lay the foundation matters later on. So when children experience trauma or adversity, whether it's, you know, domestic violence, substance abuse, community violence, it really shapes their brain in a way that we've really begun to understand in the last decade or two. So the brain is really shaped by experiences. I think the best way to think about it is that your brain will prepare you to thrive in whatever situation. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a very chaotic situation, your brain will start to undergo actual structural changes, changes in your brain architecture, changes in your in the wiring of your brain that will translate to behavioral issues. And many of those behavioral issues that we see are things that later on get children, you know, suspended from school, expelled from school, Baker acted or involved in community violence. So we know that a lot of this is due to changes in their brain architecture that make them kind of more, can make them more hyperactive, hyper responsive. It can make them perceive threats differently. So things that you or I wouldn't feel as threatening, children, adolescents can feel as threatening.
And when they like get, what? What's an example of that?
Well, I think a great example would be in a classroom. So if a child is having difficult behaviors in the classroom and they've experienced a lot of trauma and the impacts of that on their brain development, and the teacher in front of their peers kind of puts them on the spot and says, well, stop acting silly or stop doing this or get out of the classroom. So a child who is like with healthy development may respond to that pretty well. But one who's experienced toxic stress and the corresponding changes might feel threatened or put on the spot. And they may, their fight or flight response may kick in, and they may have a very hyperactive response to that.
Wow. One example of that, we're talking about the effects of toxic stress on kids here on the show today. We're all stressed out about Hurricane Dorian, but that's just part of the conversation. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. So local children have the stress that all children have, Doctor, active shooter drills in their schools. Mm-hmm. We're stressed out about our severe weather. But loaded into that, particularly in Jacksonville, you study and you work in neighborhoods where kids have all of these additional issues, poverty, neighborhood violence, substance abuse issues. There's a whole range of problems that are being loaded onto kids in this city. And you, what you're saying, what I hear you saying is Jacksonville is not adequately responding to this crisis, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we talk about child health and well-being, when we talk about child mental health, we can really think of it like a table that rests on the floor. So for a table to function appropriately, it has to be on a level floor. And if the floor is not level, it will wobble. And if it's really unbalanced, it may topple over. And for kids, the floor is their environment, their experiences, their opportunity. So if they don't have a healthy environment, if they don't have those strong, healthy relationships, if they don't have that opportunity, that table will begin to wobble and, mm-hmm. and it may topple over. And I think for many of us here, it feels like instead of addressing the levelness of the floor, what we do is put little like short-term responses to kids' experiences and environments.
And maybe putting something under one leg of the table.
Absolutely.
To kind of keep it level.
Absolutely.
Rather than fixing the floor.
Absolutely.
Okay. So how do you see the role of the city's premier child welfare agency, the Kids Hope Alliance, in getting to the root causes of these problems? Is it up to the task?
Well, I think that is the question that I, in listening to the show a lot lately, that's the question that I've been asking. I know a lot of what Kids Hope Alliance does is focuses on child programming. But to make that floor level, you can't just focus on like after school programs or programs just for children. We really have to think about the structural issues that are at play here and how to address it. And I think leveling off that floor starts with kind of creating an atmosphere, an environment where all children can thrive. And I think it's a question of whether Kids Hope Alliance thinks that that's their mission or not. And if not, what are the alternatives? How can we as a community address those issues?
And what would be some of the alternatives? Because, of course, as we've been following here at WJCT, the Kids Hope Alliance is currently roiled in controversy. Its embattled director is on administrative leave after he accused the mayor's office of improperly pressuring KHA to award crime prevention microgrants to politically favored churches and organizations. So politics has cast a cloud right now over the work of the Kids Hope Alliance.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we know for sure is that transformative changes in child health and well-being outcomes or community violence don't really happen in like 4-year political cycles. So I think if the lead or the premier child health organization in the city is kind of embroiled in that, the question is, what can we do to really address the structural long-term issues for child health and well-being in the city?
And let's talk about that, because there are a group of advocates in this city, including you, who are working on a child-friendly cities initiative for Jacksonville. You're working to implement children's rights as articulated in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. Tell me about the Child-Friendly Cities Initiative.
Well, I think the Child Friendly City Initiative really aims to put child health and well-being into pretty much every decision that we make in the city. And it aims to engage young people in those discussions. So I think I've heard lots of topics about things that are going on in the city, but very rarely do I think we engage young people in those decisions or even factor in what their opinions may be. Or a lot of times when we think about, you know, whether it's changes in downtown, whether it's changes in the schools, what do the young people need to make the city more responsive to their experiences?
Okay. And what you're arguing for, which other advocates have argued for, mm-hmm. is a stable and sustainable independent funding source for this effort, which is politically difficult to get going.
Absolutely. I think it is politically difficult, but critically important. I think there's examples now all around the country of programs that have been successful in improving child health and well-being outcomes. But then when the funding changes happen, the success goes away. And I think it's also hard for people who are doing the work to kind of plan the long-term initiatives that are needed when the funding cycles can be so short and unpredictable. So I think having a sustainable funding source that's independent, that kind of can focus on both short-term and long-term outcomes, will give us an opportunity to really develop that kind of comprehensive
plan.
And
where would this money go? How would it be spent?
Well, I think that would be there. I think there's a lot of different ways, but I think most importantly, it would be developing a comprehensive strategy, looking at, well, what do our kids need? Thinking about equity. So what do kids who have different experiences and different opportunities, especially in the north and the west side of town, what do they need to thrive? And thinking about both short-term and long-term. So what do we do to stop the violence, like immediately? But also, if we think about violence as kind of the very extreme end of a spectrum, there's all these intermediate outcomes where show that our kids aren't thriving. So how do we address all of them?
Look at the difficulty the school board has had just in getting a referendum on the ballot to fix up some of the school buildings in the poorer and more African-American parts of town. And you're saying, well, we need a lot more than that. What's your response to people listening who would say, no, we don't need to keep throwing more money at the problem? Because that's always what people say when someone like you makes these arguments. They'll say, you just want us to throw money at the problem. What's your response?
Well, I think improved outcomes, increased public safety, all the discussions that we're having really start with creating a community where all children can thrive. And right now, we're not doing that. So we're going to spend the money no matter what, whether it's on ShotSpotter, whether it's on youth detention, whether it's on other incarceration-related outcomes. If we invest now in children early, we know that we're going to get that money back. And I listen to the show every day, and I always hear about downtown, downtown, downtown. And it seems like when we are spending money,
maybe we focus too much on that.
Well, no, I think it's great to focus on it. But I think when we talk about spending money downtown, we always say it's an investment that we're going to get the money back. It's going to be great from Jacksonville. But we know when we spend money on children's programs, we get a huge investment back too. So not only are we going to be spending the money long term anyway, but it's also an investment that will save money in the long run.
Okay, let's go to your calls now. As we discuss the effects of toxic stress on Florida's kids, we are all stressed this week about Hurricane Dorian. There are lots of other problems, as Dr. Makai Owen of UF Health Jax is pointing out. It's 549-2937. Tim is in Riverside. Hi, Tim. Good morning.
Hi, how's it doing? Good morning. I'm a student. I mean, I grew up in the school system, in Jacksonville my entire life. I couldn't tell you what it is now, but just a few years ago, we were 50 out of 50 for the amount of money we spent on education and had a record streak like up until that point. This is obviously reflecting the school when it's funny that you mentioned the hurricane, because as a student, I see that all students are pretty much excited about that, which is sort of just goes to show how sad, that is, because we are putting, we're allocating funds where they don't need to be. And our solution is to do gun drills, gun safety, like violence training, things like that, things that contribute to the culture of fear, the culture of violence. You've been talking about this for a couple weeks, and it's something that I find quite interesting. Going further with that is also, as you were saying, the amount of violence, in the city. I feel like if we focus more on mental health in our schools and also specialized education, individual education, within the classroom, also outside of the classroom, that would be a much more better solution to whatever violence we may be experiencing than these gun and safety drills that, like I said, plays into the culture of fear, plays into the culture of violence. So that's just my two cents.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. Thanks for that. Makai Owen.
Yeah, I think a couple of great points. I think I agree we don't spend enough money in education here, but the schools can't do it alone. If we had the most most perfect school system, and we sent kids home to communities with murders and violence and systemic issues. The schools can't fix that problem. So I think, again, taking that kind of comprehensive approach. And another thing I think that we hear a lot about is mental health. And I think that term is getting thrown around a lot lately, and I'm not always sure what it means. But again, I think mental health for children and adolescents especially starts from a situation where all children can thrive. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an unfair expectation to me to expect children who have been kind of exposed to certain experiences, whether it's community violence, domestic violence, opioids, things like that, to be able to kind of function perfectly. We want them to behave in this ideal manner regardless of their experiences. And again, to me, it goes back to the table. We would never expect the table to stand up on a slanted floor, but that's what we expect from our kids.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good analogy and a visual, I think, that helps people understand better what you're talking mm-hmm. about, because it removes judgment and it provides some context.
Absolutely.
So thanks for that. Anne on the West Side. Hi, Anne.
Hi, good morning. I want to thank Dr. Owen for taking the initiative to help young ones, but it makes me think of almost trying to put Neosporin on a third-degree burn. What do children do at the end of the day? They come back home, and if the home environment is stressful, my husband and I, we're both professionals. We live on the West Side. Shot spotters don't make me feel more comfortable. I don't know what – we're almost like a forgotten side of town over here. If you, any side of town, if you start to see these large boxes with flashing light, would that make you feel more comfortable on the weekend? It's been about 5 years. We would hear an occasional shot. We would all panic. We would call 911. It's not uncommon for us to lay in bed and go count the shots. Well, we heard five shots. That's not normal.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be normal. What's going on? I drive all over town, and in the profession that I'm in, I see all the investment on the south side, all this built. Buildings going up, growth. The West Side, pawn shops, topless bars. We had to install a Ring doorbell. When you start to look in your neighborhood, what's going on? We had someone climb our fence at 1 a.m. in the morning, come across my front yard and with a bag full of items. If you don't have the parents, don't have the adults, stress or lessen. There's never be stress-free, but if you don't have our stress lessened, with the city, how do you expect the children? It's just that trickle-down effect.
Absolutely, Anne. Yeah, thank you so much for that. As we talk about the effects of toxic stress on kids, Dr. Owen, as you've been pointing out, kids' brains are still developing, mm-hmm. and the stress has a profoundly negative effect on their brain development. That said, adults are stressed out, too, and that's not good for the children that are around them.
Absolutely. And I think it creates also a cycle of generational trauma. So one thing that we often do with parents in clinic who have experienced lots of trauma or have experienced, you know, the things in marginalized communities, violence or poverty, is helping them to learn how to parent through the trauma. So similar to the kids now, the parents who were kids also had those changes in brain development, and it may cause them to have issues with patience or being hyper-aggressive, or when they get upset with their kids, they may respond really harshly because they themselves have been impacted by trauma. And I think it creates a cycle which leads to further changes in brain architecture, further changes in the physiological stress response that leads to behavioral issues that kind of just get worsens and cycles and leads to a lot of the poor outcomes that we see in our communities.
Yeah. And how would you characterize, I mean, we've talked about the numbers you have at hand, but how would you characterize the Jacksonville area and compare it to other cities around the country? Because certainly gun violence is a problem everywhere. Mm-hmm. Poverty and the cycle of abuse, the generational trauma, it's a problem everywhere. But do you feel that Jacksonville is especially burdened with this issue?
Absolutely. And the numbers say so. Be in the bottom third of the bottom third. But even with that, so we know there's significant disparities and inequities. So if our kids overall are doing that poorly, imagine what the outcomes look like for kids in certain areas. And I think it's really important to at least think about or talk about why that is and what are the kind of structural issues that are in play there. Like I said before, whether it's racism, whether it's, you know, consolidation, segregation, all the different reasons that cause certain kids and families to not have the same opportunities that other kids and families have.
That's the thing, too, that we touched on that a lot on this show, and it bears touching on again. This really is a tale of two cities, and it's stark. If you live south and east of the St. John's River, you are more likely to be in a middle-class two-parent household than if you're a child who lives north and west of the St. John's River. Yeah. It's pretty stark.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that we talk about that. But also, you know, it's not luck why that happened. It's not random. There's decisions that we as a community and we as a society have made throughout time that kind of perpetuate those inequities.
Mm-hmm. Lisa is on the north side of Jacksonville. Hi, Lisa. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. I really appreciate the guest's point of view. We have got to have a dedicated funding source for children's services. And with an independent board making those decisions. And, you know, we have such a missed opportunity right now with a school board asking for a half penny. Is we could also do a children's services board model and have a half penny for children's services and sell it as one campaign. It's important that we have an independent body simply because of the recent scandal surrounding KHA, whether they prove to be true or not. There's always going to be that question of whether funding is being politicized. And this is an opportunity and time where you've got people very concerned about the direction of our city regarding kids that we need to really have this conversation.
Lisa, thanks for that. Yeah, and, you know, we're talking about this on the heels of the city council meeting the other night, Dr. Owen, where the public was literally thrown out of the city council chambers because of the contentiousness of whether or not people should be able to vote on this half-cent sales tax for schools. And that's just a basic infrastructure referendum, shoring up some of the oldest school buildings in Florida that are crumbling. You know, kids are going to school without decent air conditioning, without decent plumbing. A lot of kids go to school in places on the northwest side in rooms that don't have any windows. I mean, it goes on and on. Kids in portables that aren't up to code. And so this argument that we need an independent children's services council, that's a more broad-based look at this than what the school board is trying to do with the half penny tax, right?
Absolutely. And I think the perception certainly right now is everything, and including the funding, has been very politicized. And I think it's hard to make strategic decisions about long-term outcomes in a situation where things are politicized. When it comes to community violence, one thing that we often think about is what would it look like if we said that starting January 1, 2020, we're going to really invest to make sure that every baby born has an equal opportunity to thrive or lives in an equitable community. What changes would we make? And I think when you take that kind of mind frame or approach to it, that really is a 10, 15-year plan, and it's not going to fit into a neat political cycle.
What were your thoughts about the Jacksonville Journey Initiative, which tried to get at some of these structural problems you've been talking about? It hit the rocky shoals of the economic downturn in 2008, 2009. It lost funding. Different mayors changed its approach, defunded it. It got folded into the Kids Hope Alliance. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it definitely appeared to have some significant success, but without an independent funding source, I think it's similar to what happens all around the country. When the money kind of changes a little bit or is unpredictable, the program goes away. And I think because these programs take oftentimes, in my opinion, too much of a narrow focus, when they're not there, kind of immediately the outcomes go back the other way. And I think we've seen that. Which is why I think we need to start really thinking about the root causes and how we can address the root causes.
Rena is in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Rena.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I wanted to raised the issue of the 2020 census, and that my understanding is that Duval has a very high, what they call hard to count population of young children. And what that means is if we, for every child we miss, we are leaving just hundreds, if not thousands of federal dollars on the table for Head Start and other really key resources. And the census will be an electronic census this year for the very first time. And I'm working with a lot of other nonprofit organizations and the Florida Nonprofit Alliance to make sure that there's a true awareness campaign, and particularly reaching out to parents of young children to make sure they're counted so that our region gets its fair share of federal resources to support kids. And I thought it might be a good time to raise that issue since you all are talking about.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that to our attention, Rena. Yeah, thanks for that. Dr. Owen.
Well, I think it is absolutely important that everyone gets counted. But again, going back to the broader question, the one that I raise is, why are some kids difficult to count? And I think it's related to the way certain communities and certain youth and certain families are kind of traditionally and ongoing marginalized and disenfranchised.
Lots of tweets on this. Here's one from the Teal Zone. He says, kids pick up stress from their parents. If mom and dad are calm, prepared, and have good talks, kids will be all right. If not, there's not much we can do to help the kids combat their parents. I'll get you to respond to that in a moment. Here is a tweet from Tony Allegretti. Art can help. There's an increase in arts and culture funding in this year's budget. Thanks for that. Brian tweets the show, about 70 years ago, a child likely had just one toy. Does consumerism add distress? Jim tweets the show, what about proper child nutrition in reducing stress in children? Lots of feedback coming into you.
So I think a couple things. First, we hear this very often with parents. And of course, we have to remember that parents themselves were children and they themselves experienced trauma and inequities in our community. So we will put a lot of responsibility on what parents need to do. We will put a lot of responsibility on what children need to do and what schools need to do. But in my opinion, we don't put the same kind of responsibility on what we as a community or society can do to address those issues.
Scott is in Riverside. Hi, Scott. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hi. I just had a quick question about the discussion earlier about the comparison between Jacksonville and other similar cities and how kids in Jacksonville are worse off. I understand the murder rate is something unique to Jacksonville, but when I think about the story of Jacksonville, it's not all that different from other deep South cities like Memphis or Norfolk or Durham, North Carolina. So I was curious as to what kind of numbers you all were referencing there when it comes to why Jacksonville is, or how Jacksonville is worse off, and then and why that might be.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, I think it's interesting that you pointed to the cities in the deep South because many of the cities in the deep South experience the same structural inequities. So I think Jacksonville is comparable to many of those cities. But I think what we referenced early is that overall Florida ranks 45th in economic well-being for children, 24th in education, 40th for health, 33rd for various family and community metrics. And so that's bottom third. And again, Duval County is in the bottom third in those same metrics in Florida. So it's not just community violence, it's outcomes and metrics against a whole host of categories.
Okay. And so given that there was a child-friendly city conference recently held in Jacksonville with health professionals and advocates like yourself, the groundswell for this is growing. But that said, there isn't the political will to execute this. So what is your strategy and those that are with you on this as you look ahead?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one, we have to continue the conversation about the need for independent funding source with an independent board. But in the meantime, in thinking that right now that's not possible, what can we do, those who work with kids, those in the safety net community, the nonprofits, kind of how can we get together and kind of all move in one direction? How can we think about a comprehensive strategy? And then how can we empower young people and families to express their experiences and to let us know what their lived experience is like so that we can respond appropriately.
they know how to get a hold of you.
Absolutely.
You're Makai Owen, MD, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at UF College of Health, Jax, and a child health advocate. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Much more still ahead. Later, Andy Zip performs live in studio. It's a preview of his show at the Blue Jay. But up next, the growth of arts and culture over the last decade in Jacksonville as we celebrate 10 years on the air here. We'll be right back.
Hey, Melissa, it's Ann Schindler. I just wanted to say congratulations on your 10-year anniversary. You are an incredible and important voice in this town. We appreciate you, and thanks for all of your awesomeness.
A1A Solar designs and installs residential and commercial solar electric systems. NABCET certified A1A Solar provides sustainable and financially efficient energy solutions. Learn whether solar is right for you with a 5-question quiz at a1asolar.com.
Melissa, Matt Shaw, editor at Void Magazine here. Wanted to say happy 10th anniversary for First Coast Connect. M. Ross, you're a boss. We love you.
Welcome back. Well, this week we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of First Coast Connect, but we thought we'd use that as an excuse to look at some of the big changes we've observed around town over the last decade. And that includes the growth of the arts and culture community. Prominent arts advocate Robert Artley White has been following that too. And he has some thoughts for us right now. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm really well, and it's so good to have you this morning.
It's always nice to be on your show, and congratulations. I cannot believe it's been 10 years.
Neither can I.
I bet. What an astonishing thing. What a remarkable milestone. Good on you.
Thank you. And, you know, as someone who led the Cultural Council for more than 10 years.
Many.
You know.
Hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years. For eons.
For eons, yes.
You know what goes into, you know, keeping something going for a long time, and all the kudos to you for that.
Well, you're very
because
kind.
You're
Thank
a
you.
Prominent person in this community who's grown the arts and culture space. And so you, I think, have a really unique perspective on this. When you look over the last decade or so, what's the biggest thing that jumps out at you first off?
Well, there are probably two big things that jump out at me. And one is the whole nature and spirit of collaboration that exists among our cultural institutions. And I think that that was organically grown by leaders like Hope McMath, Michael Boylan, Maria Haynes, certainly, who really understood that a rising tide floats all boats. It is really tricky work, nonprofit work here in Northeast Florida, and arts work in particular is very tricky. But as a function of that, what we have in Northeast Florida is remarkable. You know, American InStyle magazine for like a number of years, and maybe even currently, named Jacksonville, Florida, as one of the top 25 arts destinations in America. Hmm. And you know, the first time I came across that, I thought, who paid them how much to say that? But when you think about it, we've got one of two professionally operating symphonies with local musicians in the state of Florida. We have the largest museum dedicated to the presentation of contemporary art in the Southeast. Mm-hmm. We have the longest running, continuously producing community theater in the cosmos. I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches. It really is.
Right. So many theaters, museums, performers, actors, artists of all stripes. Mm-hmm. We've got Art Republic now, these mm-hmm. incredible murals that mm-hmm. Have gone up around the urban core. There's so many things we could point to.
Well, actually, and that leads to the second thing that I think has been really, really, really important. I think the focus for many years has been on institutions, and our institutions certainly are remarkable. But now what we have is a real celebration of and recognition of the individual artist and what that person does and what that person brings to our quality of life. In a lot of ways, because I am so old, I'm like older than I've ever been. But way back in the 70s or 80s, there was a real sort of feel for art's sake that we lost for all kinds of reasons. Yeah. That's a whole other thing. Yeah. But that's back in a way. But the thing that is different and exciting is that a lot of these things seem to be very issue-driven. Really, really sort of enmeshed in what is going on in the world around us right now. Even, for example, with Cultural Fusion, which is an astonishing collaborative venture, the notion that we're going to do a whole year of programming that focuses on our river or uplifting unheard or soft voices in our community. That is, it's a brave step. It's a creative step. It's an inspiring step.
So art has become more of a vehicle in this community for social change.
I would say so. Absolutely. I mean, just look at what Hope McMath is doing with mm-hmm. Yellow House. It's mm-hmm. just incredible and inspiring. And she's very brave, I have to say.
She is. Absolutely. So given all the progress, what are the big challenges?
Oh, golly, where to begin?
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the big, big, big challenges is that we're just so big and so spread out. You know, the story I told you a little bit ago, you know, one of the top 25 destinations, and who knows that in our city, who would know that? But if you took everything that we had and like squashed it into, I don't know, one place, it would be incredible, you know, what we have. That's the first thing. The second thing is I don't know that we always do the best job of telling our own story. I think there really is a kind of a stigma, oh, you know, I'm from Jacksonville, which is sort of silly because the arts kind of lead in a lot of ways. There's a lot to be proud of. And then, of course, the big, big, big thing, it's true for everybody, is, you know, funding. You know, I heard the comment earlier that there's more funding in this year's budget, but it's still less than 0.25% of the total city. Now, what are you supposed to do with that? Well, mm-hmm. you know, creative people do a lot. And we heard that all the time. And we still do. You're creative. You can do more with less. And I think, well, that doesn't make sense logically or mathematically. You do more with more. That's how that gets done, right?
Because as you know, as the Cultural Council will point out, and you pointed out when you led it, for every dollar the city invests in art and culture, they get a pretty hefty return. It's an economic development investment.
It is quite remarkable. And depending upon who you talk to, that return is anywhere from $14 to $32.
That's a pretty smart investment.
But, you know, Greg Anderson, who until recently was on our city council, used to say it was the smartest investment that the city made mm-hmm. because of that return on investment.
Yeah. Okay. So the individual artist, art is a vehicle for social change.
Yeah.
And then also Jacksonville just becoming more, getting some swagger, you think, is the big thing that needs to happen around our artistic focus. Miami has Art Basel. It's mm-hmm. known around the world. Charleston has the Spoleto Festival,
right. uh-huh.
known around the world. And so the big challenge then is how does this community put itself on the international map with something similar? We kind of saw an effort at that with One Spark.
Right.
And then that faded off.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that was unfortunate.
It was. But, you know, I think there are little things that are going on that are very, very useful. I have got to point to our airport, which for many, many people is their first introduction to the city. And that airport lands on everybody's list of one of the most beautiful airports. The accessibility that you have to art and culture just at the airport is it's really impressive.
It is. And it's beautiful.
Well, it really is. And the airport is so generous because they hand over a lot of spaces that ordinarily would be revenue generating for them, advertising opportunities or whatever, to art and culture. You know, every single entrance to every single restroom is an art installation at our airport. It's amazing.
Yeah. That is important to point out because, mm-hmm. as you said, that's the first impression a lot of visitors to this community mm-hmm. receive. And as we talk about the last 10 years of art and culture on the First Coast with Robert Arley White, We are taking a few calls for him. Let's go to Ted. He's in the Timaquan Preserve. Hi, Ted. Go ahead. You're on the air. I know they were still putting you in the queue, but go ahead.
So I just wanted to congratulate you for your 10 years.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and also wanted to thank you and your staff for everything you do to keep our community so well informed. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. And any thoughts about art?
Well, I'm listening now, and I'm just excited about opportunities upcoming for new art projects and new initiatives. And we're looking forward to opportunities to take part in, if we can, through our community engagement. So we're going to be learning a lot through this broadcast and future.
Sure.
Broadcast.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you.
So what is on the radar? What's on your radar screen?
You know, what I'm really, really excited about is what is going to be happening at the Museum of Science and History. That transformation is going to be remarkable. And the way it will create access to experiences on the river, the way Maria Hain inculcates art with just about
everything. She leads that museum.
She is astonishing.
And they're planning a massive renovation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. An $80 million transformation of that building.
And it's going to better engage the river is what I understand.
That's exactly right. You know, it's funny because right now you can go there and have an amazing experience, but the building is on the river and you wouldn't know it from the inside.
Yeah.
You know, but I think Maria's commitment to that experience will translate into a really user-friendly, technologically on point resource for all of us. And especially right now where science is so important, she really does have a great understanding of how art and science complement each other. So it's really tremendous.
Well, that's something to watch out for. But as Bob has been pointing out, we have become an arts destination. So take some time to go to a museum,
absolutely,
a play, a concert. There are so many incredible talents all around this community doing their thing, and just get out and enjoy it because it's really in full flower and it really is exciting to see.
That's exactly right. And your participation as an audience member, as a volunteer, and especially as a donor makes all the difference in the world. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this.
Thank you.
And congratulations. I'm so excited for you. I brought you treats.
I know. We can't wait to try them.
I love treats.
You know how much any newsroom loves treats, too. So you just scored a lot of points with everybody here. So thank you, Robert Arley White. It is always so good to see you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
In a moment. Speaking of art, a live in studio performance from singer-songwriter Andy Ziff. It's a preview of his show at the Blue Jay this weekend. Don't go away because that is coming up in just a few minutes here on First Coast Connect on 89.9 as we celebrate 10 years on the air this week. Keep listening.
Good morning. This is Harold, Corporate Marketing. Melissa, congratulations. What a wonderful ride. Stay on board. Well done, my friend. You go, girl.
I'm Marco Werman. Each day, we give you the world.
We don't want people driving into the center of London.
The world is curious.
It's a total chaos in Venezuela right now.
The world is surprising.
The Australian government is completely clueless.
The world is unexpected.
The Japanese really have made history today.
The world is right here. Join us this afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
September will be upon us this weekend. So, too, will be a whole new set of tariffs on Chinese imports.
The net effect of the tariff is it's not going to punish the Chinese. Well, who it's going to punish is the American dealers who will have to pay this tariff to bring it into the country.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, antiques to ballpoint pens. Next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, our Emmy week continues with two nominees in the category Best Lead Actress in a Comedy Series, Christina Applegate, who stars in Dead to Me, and Natasha Lyonne, who co-created and stars in the series Russian Doll. Lyonne has a second nomination for her writing on Russian Doll. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Minnesota's farmers are suffering. Their governor hopes to find relief for these growers and find new ways to grow the economy, including possibly legalizing recreational marijuana. Governor Tim Walz takes your questions live from the Minnesota State Fair, including on a major controversy here. Does he prefer corn dogs or Pronto Pups? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Singer-songwriter Andy Zip recently relocated to the Beaches area from Washington, D.C., and we've got a special treat because Andy's performing Friday night at the Blue Jay Listening Room, and he's joining us now with a preview and a live performance here in studio. Andy Zip, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to have you on the show. Your music has won raves for years now. You've put out a number of albums, and in fact, I'm reading, you were one of the first musicians to fund your tour solely off $2 donations of your fans. So you were an early disruptor of the music marketing business model. Isn't that right?
Well, I thank you for that. I'll take the podium there. That was pretty long ago. But my manager and I at the time did ask people to just donate $2, and we ended up raising enough money to go out to California and back.
Wow.
That was my first tour to the West Coast.
And what brought you to Jacksonville from the D.C. area?
So I had an opportunity. I got a position at a Presbyterian church here as a director of music and artist in residence, and it came at just the right time because music is my life. I spent more than half my life pursuing this career, and this opportunity allows me to provide for my family and continue to do what I feel I'm most skilled at doing and what I love to do.
You're going to be performing Friday night at Blue Jay. We've got a preview right now. Tell us a little bit about the music you're working on now and what we're going to hear.
I'm going to play a couple songs that one of them is on an album called Jealous Hands that I worked with a friend, a producer from actually the Fort Walton Beach area. So another, not too close, but another Florida neighbor. The songs I've been writing since moving down here, just about the different, what the different landscape looks like, you know, dragonflies and not the kind of things that you see in Virginia as opposed to Florida. You know, fatherhood and transition and things like that.
Excellent. Let's listen now to Andy Zip.
Okay.
In the lazy hour, just another stretch through the summer shower, couple miles ahead. In the rising moment, the horizon breaks. Cut the fever open, let the healing take. Here comes a silence hanging on. Sound of our misery come and go. I'm going up to where my heroes died. Let the song see me one more time. Getting covered in the cool tonight. The road is narrow, but the reach is wide. It's a revelation burning up in me. Oh, prophet speaking out of melody. Here comes a silence hanging on. Sound of our misery come and gone. I'm going up to where my heroes died. Let the song see me one more time. I'm getting covered in the cool tonight. The road is narrow, but the reach is wide. The reach is wide. The reach is wide. Never been easy in a shallow faith. Gonna short you a dollar and an hour late. Here comes a silence hanging on. The sound of our misery come and go. I'm going up to where my heroes die. Let the song see me one more time. I'm getting covered in the cool tonight. The road is narrow, but the reach is wide. I wanna remember when the music made ya. Keep a rhythm on the record player. A little mystery I can't describe. I'm going out to Mulholland Drive.
Beautiful. Andy Zip, you are amazing. Thank you for that performance. Gorgeous.
Thank you.
What a treat to hear that. And that's just a short preview of Andy's show tomorrow night at the Blue Jay Listening Room. He's Andy Zip. Go see his show. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you so much.
Well, that is our show today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. We value your feedback. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Speaking of music, if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, music's coming up. We'll see you tomorrow.
Cover my head to hide. I found a way to suffer without you knowing, dear. Don't have the heart to tell ya. I name the field so it won't grow, it won't grow. I need a reason we can hold.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.